This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, distinguished attorney Bill Quigley joins us to talk about a jury's recent decision in the Kings Bay Plowshare 7 case.
The Georgia jury was only out for a mere 3 hours before it found the courageous defendants guilty on all counts. Now they're looking at 20 years in prison.
76-year-old Jamil Al-Amin is in prison in Tucson, Arizona, having been targeted by the FBI and the CIA for being a successful 60s and 70s radical activist.
This is the story of the government's largely successful attempt to crush the Black Freedom Movement and its international connections.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, last week we had a couple of pieces of really tremendous news. I was personally delighted to hear, and it was a surprise, that the U.S. House of Representatives voted 405-11 to adopt a resolution affirming that the U.S. acknowledges the Armenian genocide. And what this means is the U.S. will commemorate the official genocide, but it will also reject efforts from Turkey and anywhere else to associate the U.S. government with genocide denial, and it will encourage education and a more public understanding of the facts of the first genocide of the 20th century, the Armenian genocide.
Well, the United States has blocked that for a century, for 100 years. They've blocked that. So it's a big victory to be able to talk about it.
And we should note they blocked it because they've seen Turkey as an important ally. But another huge victory, really, this was won at the hands of the people. The Trump administration, we learned, is fully withdrawing its plan that we've covered on Law and Disorder to block free speech and assembly through park regulations that would have quashed protest on federal lands in the nation's capital. And this comes after a well-orchestrated grassroots effort by literally hundreds of groups who mobilized to push back on these proposed regulations.
Yeah, we have them to thank in the first place. And we also have Mara Verheiden Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice to thank because she understands the importance of grassroots mobilization. And she's a lawyer that says, it's just not about me, it's about everybody, and we've got to get everybody involved. And they did, and they rolled back those awful regulations. They were going to charge people for permits. They were going to charge people to use the city. They were blocking people from the sidewalk in front of the White House. They were doing everything they could to squash freedom of expression, and we won that one. It's a big victory. In our society, nuclear weapons that can destroy all creation are taken as a normal, even an inevitable part of life. In a dramatic action to break what they call the crime of silence, 7 Catholic peace activists in the Plowshares movement entered the Kings Bay Trident submarine base in Georgia last April to perform an act of symbolic disarmament. They were arrested, tried 2 weeks ago, and quickly convicted on October 24th of 2019 in a Georgia court. They face more than 20 years in prison. Kings Bay is home port to 6 ballistic missile Trident submarines, each of which deploy 16 Trident missiles carrying 4 or more warheads of at least 100 kilotons. The Hiroshima bomb was 14 kilotons. Each submarine thus has the destructive power of at least 500 Hiroshima bombs. We speak today with their attorney, Professor Bill Quigley. Bill's a former legal director at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He practices and teaches law in New Orleans at Loyola University.
Bill Quigley, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Well, glad to be here.
we were distressed at the recent court decision in the case of the Plowshare 7, and we understand you're representing one person, Liz McAllister. What specifically did Liz do?
Well, in April of last year, she was part of a group of seven people who went on to the Kings Bay Naval Station in Georgia, where we house, we being the government, the U.S. government houses a number of nuclear weapons that operate out of a submarine fleet that operates there. They estimate that the damage that could be caused by just the submarines out of that station are 3,800 times as severe as what happened in Hiroshima. So they went onto the base, cut through the fence, went onto the base. She and two other people held up a sign, nuclear weapons are immoral and illegal, in front of a storage facility for some of the weapons. Others of the group went to a missile shrine, a display that was honoring the various kinds of lethal missiles that are launched from ships operating out of that naval station. And they dismantled some of the signage, and they poured blood on the some of their own blood on the sidewalk around there and the like, put biblical and peace slogans all around. According to the government, caused about, over $20,000 worth of damage. But they stayed there on that night. They went in at night. They stayed there and waited to be detained. And we just finished the trial in federal court in Brunswick, Georgia, last week.
And what crimes were they charged with?
Each of the seven was charged with three felonies and one misdemeanor. Felony of conspiracy to commit damage against the United States, a felony of damage of property of the United States for over $1,000, and another felony for damage to property of the United States of over $1,000, but they call it a slightly different crime. They call it depredation of property that is part of a military base, and then also the misdemeanor of trespass.
And when you went in to pick the jury, what kind of jury did you want to hear the arguments?
Well, the point of the whole action was to remind all of us of the incredible life-ending potential of these weapons that we continue to develop and deploy all around the world. And so we realized that this new Navy base was a gigantic employer in the area, but we were hoping to get some people on the base who had some questions about nuclear weapons, who could understand the concept of civil disobedience, who could understand the idea of people taking some small actions in order to prevent a much larger, horrendous crime. We're brought in a group of 70. One of the questions that we got the judge to ask the group was, how many of you have some moral questions about, the use of nuclear weapons? And we looked around the room, and not a single one of the 70 people raised their hands. And as we went through the questioning of the jury, most everybody of that 70-person jury pool was connected in some way with law enforcement, military, or the base. We were able, from that 70, to get, to see 12 people who were a cross-section, I think, of that community, but the community is very, very pro-military, very pro-defense, and very pro-Navy and this base. And so plus we had the extra burden of we really didn't get a jury of the peers of the people on trial, but the extra burden was that the government was very aggressive in presenting to the court motions to exclude all evidence of nuclear weapons, all evidence of international law, all evidence of the defense of necessity, all evidence about prohibitions on genocide, all evidence about religious freedom and the like, of which this Plowshare 7 were all Catholic workers who have, you know, both a religious and a political tradition of opposing nuclear weapons for their absolute immorality. And all of that was, excluded from the jury. And so we had a several-day trial. It's a tough job to be a lawyer in these circumstances, but these are wonderful, wonderful people, so it's an honor to represent them.
Yes, we were able to meet several of them, and they truly are wonderful people. Bill Quigley, what did you say to the jury in your opening statement?
The judge gave us a little bit of latitude to talk about morality and religious conviction as part of the motivation of the individuals who took this action, but they were very clear that in the instruction to the jury that they were to disregard that. But so we stressed who these individuals were, that they are people. My client, Elizabeth McAllister, married to Phil Berrigan, founded Jonah House, 79 years old, going to be 80 next month, spent her entire life opposing war and nuclear weapons. So tried to tell those stories to give the jurors the information about what was going on, and told the jury, you know, is this about a crime that occurred, or is this about the prevention of a crime? And so tried to introduce who these folks were, what they did, because they didn't, they didn't deny the actions that they took, and then started down the road of why they took the actions that they did. And that's the road that they were very, very restricted in being able to journey down.
You know, Bill, we've seen a few rare but positive developments in a lot of environmental cases where judges are starting to let the necessity defense into court. And, you know, Michael and I are sitting here in the studio surprised that with headlines on the possibility of nuclear war, increasing tensions between nation states, as well as environmental issues, that basically barring you from raising the necessity defense, especially in international treaties, really robbed you of any case. And of course, you better than anyone know that part of the importance of bringing these cases is to educate the public about what's going on. Well, how did you feel when you were barred from all of that? And could you talk about what the necessity defense, how you might have presented that in court?
The necessity defense, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, is the idea that if you're going down a street and you see a house on fire and up in the upper story window you see a child who can't get out, that probably are okay to break and enter into that house to try to prevent, a bigger disaster from happening. And so the idea is that as a defense to a minor crime, you can point and educate the jury to the major evil, the major crime that you're trying to prevent. And you're right, the necessity defense, it goes back hundreds of years, but the necessity defense is having a resurgence in environmental defense actions, civil disobedience and the like. Those actions so far have been in state courts. The federal courts are really pretty brutal about allowing the government to stop any discussion of, you know, the context in which these actions happen. From the government's perspective, this was simply a case about some vandals who cut a fence, went into some property, and sprayed paint and blood on that. And from the government's perspective, this is the same as if people did this to a used car lot. The fact that it was a naval base where we store and deploy and maintain and improve weapons that can end life on Earth as we know it They didn't want the jury to talk about that. They didn't want they got the court to instruct the jury that this was not something that they could take on. In fact, before the case went to the jury, we had asked the judge to allow us to put on evidence of from the government's own documents, the website for the naval base, talking about how many nuclear-armed submarines are there, how many weapons are on each submarine, how many warheads are on each weapon, the proceedings in the Senate and the House, efforts by internationally recognized figures, including many people who served in cabinets for Republican and Democratic administrations, to talk about that. And the court just refused to allow any of that to be presented to the jury. So the jury got a very, very narrow slice of what happened. Fortunately, the Kings Bay Plowshares had well over 100 people there in court supporting them, and each evening they gathered to really tell the rest of the story that the jury was not getting a chance to hear. We had an expert on international law who was prepared to come and speak, Professor Boyle. We had a Catholic bishop and a Catholic theologian who were ready to come and testify. Both of those actually were there at the court, but prohibited from testifying about the position of the Catholic Church is that this is absolutely immoral, and people have a right to take action to try and stop the kinds of the nuclear holocaust that would result from the use of these weapons. But the court just went along with the government and allowed the jury to remain in the dark about what the point of this was, and also pointedly told them that they are not allowed to talk about nuclear weapons, and that that's totally irrelevant to the charges that were before them.
Bill, on the issue of not talking about international law and treaties restricting weaponry, I'm confused, because international law is also the law of the land. And
exactly.
Aren't you allowed to at least cite those as legal propositions in furtherance of your argument? So isn't it separate from the actual argument to have citations?
Well, we asked the court to allow us to introduce the treaties. We
right.
asked the court to allow an expert to explain what these treaties mean and the role that, you know, that plays in terms of our own Constitution, where it is a part of our own Constitution, as you point out, that international treaties entered into by the United States are the law of the land, the same as the state laws, the federal laws, and everything else. But the court absolutely prohibited any evidence about that and was very, very strict, even to allow the prohibiting the defendants from discussing that among themselves. I mean, among while they testified. Each six of the seven did testify. Father Stephen Kelly refused to testify because of the nature of the proceedings. But people tried to talk about it, and they were cut off and silenced by the court at the urging of the prosecution. They tried to talk about nuclear weapons themselves, and they were shut off. In fact, one of the witnesses even was Martha Hennessy, was a retired occupational therapist. For her to even explain how she treated victims of radiation, and that the government objected and the court directed her that she couldn't even talk about that, was just the idea that there would be consequences from nuclear weapons was stifled. So, not surprisingly, the jury convicted these seven people on all counts, and we are going to go back before the court in 60 to 90 days for sentencing. They're looking at the maximum sentences under these law under these felonies around 20 years. We think, given the guidelines and the federal sentencing guidelines and the like, that people are looking at far less than that, we hope. But we're going to be fighting about that. The government takes this very, very, very seriously. and rejected all ideas about this was civil disobedience or this was protest. This was just criminal action, and they intended to send a signal to these seven, but to everybody else, about the consequences for that.
We're speaking with law professor Bill Quigley, who just finished a trial in Georgia of the Plowshares 7. Bill, just to underscore this, it's my understanding that nuclear weapons, because they're totally indiscriminate and would kill everybody, not just people in the military, because they're so indiscriminate, that they're illegal. But you were not able to discuss that at all, were you?
No, we specifically gave notice that we intended to talk about their illegality under international law, under treaties, but also under U.S. criminal law, which prohibits genocide, prohibits crimes against civilians and the like, so that even apart from international law and treaties and that, you know, no soldier is allowed, no naval seaman, no pilot, nobody is allowed to take any actions that put civilians at any disproportionate risk. And clearly, any use whatsoever of any of these weapons cannot possibly be limited to just military targets only. There's plenty of people don't think it should even be used against military targets, but people who believe that it should be used against military targets have to admit that the consequences for all civilians in that area of the world, not just in the area of where the bomb goes off, because we know from the fact that the United States is the only country who's ever used nuclear weapons against people, we know that you have the immediate deaths, you have the short-term deaths, and then you have the long-term deaths that come from bombs that are the equivalent of a pencil and paper compared to, you know, a printing press. The bombs that we used in the 40s are one one-thousandth of the impact of the bombs that we have right now by the dozens on these submarines.
Bill, when is sentencing scheduled?
Sentencing will probably be early in 2020, and the U.S. Probation Department is now in the process of interviewing these folks, looking at their criminal history and the like, and trying to figure out what they want to recommend to the court. The process is they will at some point tell us, the defendants and their counsel, what they're proposing, and then we have an opportunity to respond. But usually the court follows those guidelines pretty closely. We do expect that there's going to be a significant national campaign to write letters to the judge to ask for fair sentencing given what these folks have done. And just so your listeners know, that there is a little website that's set up called Kings Bay 7 Plowshares. People just Google Kings Bay 7 Plowshares, they will find this website that has information on the trial, profiles of the individuals who went on trial, some of their statements, some of the legal pleadings that have been done, and it will be a place where actions will be coming out of in the weeks ahead. And for your listeners, too, which I know you know, the Plowshares movement is something that's been going on for decades, and over 100 actions have been taken in the United States and across the world by people who intentionally break a small law in order to try to bring attention to the end of the world scenario that we continue to pursue as a nation. And a point that one of the defendants made is, you know, it's not just the use of nuclear weapons that is immoral and illegal. And if you analogize it to somebody with a loaded pistol, if someone picks that pistol up and holds it to your head, that's a crime, even if they don't pull the trigger. And that's what's going on with the United States and the world right now. This nuclear arsenal that we have on both coasts and we have other places in the United States is part of the power that the United States exerts over people around the world in order to make sure that the business of America is allowed to be pursued wherever and however we decide is appropriate. And so people say, well, I don't think we've used the nuclear weapon for a while. We're using those weapons every day, and we are using them to back up our demand that the United States be treated in a different way than every other nation in the world, and that we get preferential treatment, that we can use their resources, et cetera.
And it's important to underscore that the United States is beefing up its nuclear arsenal and withdrawing from previously entered into treaties. But, Bill, before we have to let you go, if you don't mind, could you talk a bit about how you got involved in this kind of legal work?
So I have been a lawyer for 40 years, and I started doing civil disobedience work when representing Daniel Berrigan for actions in New Orleans, and then people at the School of Americas in Columbus, Georgia, and then various anti-nuclear, anti-drone actions around the country. It's all pro bono, of course, but it's so important that I feel it's an honor to stand beside people who are risking years in prison in order to try to point out things that are right in front of our faces that most of us choose not to look at. And so it's hard work, and it's discouraging work at times, but it's very important. These folks are going to prison for their beliefs, and the rest of us aren't. And so at least I can do that to help out.
Well, Bill Quigley, as usual, it's an honor to have you on. If Michael and I ever get arrested, we want you representing us in court for protest. But we look forward seriously to following this case and the larger significance, of course, that it has. And we applaud your work.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to help spread the word. That's very, very important. And you all have been doing that for such a long time. It's an honor to be with you.
Thank you, Bill Quigley. We'll check in with you later on. You take it easy.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
His voice had power. His booming delivery was infused with rousing socio-political rhetoric. With a rhythmic cadence, tone, and inflection, his voice kept a beat. It emboldened a generation of black youth and frightened the white establishment. Those words by Obaid Siddiqui for the news outlet Medium describe a former minister of justice for the Black Panther Party, known in the 60s and 70s as H. Rapp Brown. Once the chairperson of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Imam Jamil al-Amin was one of the original four targets of the FBI's infamous COINTELPRO program. The Bureau had called for the neutralization of al-Amin and other prominent black leaders such as Martin Luther King Jr. and Stokely Carmichael. The Bureau compiled an enormous file on al-Amin and his community. Now 76 years old, al-Amin is serving a life sentence for what many claim was a wrongful conviction in 2002 for shooting two deputy sheriffs in Atlanta, Georgia on the night of March 16, 2000. This, despite a man named Otis Jackson confessing to the shooting. Al-Amin was transferred from the ADX Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, to a medical facility in North Carolina after being diagnosed with multiple myeloma. He's currently being held at the U.S. Penitentiary in Tucson, Arizona. Joining Law and Disorder, once again, is Arun Kundani. Arun is an adjunct professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University. He also teaches terrorism studies at John Jay College. Arun, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about the background of Jamil al-Amin, formerly known as H. Rapp Brown to many. His early days as a Black Panther, his political work, including with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And after that, tell us how you came to learn about him.
Right. So He was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in 1943. Became involved in the Black Freedom Movement as a teenager, and then as a young man, as a student in Louisiana, and then in Washington D.C. So, by the time he was around about 23, 24 years old, he's become quite a prominent activist within the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. He's active in Alabama and Mississippi, doing that vote registration work. This would be kind of 65, 66. At that time, SNCC is kind of moving towards adopting the slogan of Black Power, starting to question the Vietnam War, starting to take up a whole series of issues that hadn't been part of it before. And that's when H.R.A.P. Brown becomes chair in May 1967. He's kind of a household name by that time. It's kind of on TV. He's known for being, able to communicate the political arguments of the Black Freedom Movement in a way that's accessible to people on the street. His nickname of H.R.A.P. Brown comes from that kind of ability of being able to communicate in that way. The summer of 1967, amidst the uprisings that are happening across the United States, in July 1967, he gives a speech in Cambridge, Maryland, in the middle of the local African-American community there, does his usual thing, but he finds out shortly afterwards that he's been charged with incitement to riot. The weird thing about that is that there wasn't a riot. There was a fire that the local authorities decided to let spread from a tiny little fire in a local school that had been set fire to several times before that year. But on that night, the fire authorities said, let's just let that, the police authorities actually, with the fire authorities, said, let's just let that fire spread, and a whole part of the Black community in Cambridge, Maryland was burned down, and it became described as a riot. That enabled them to charge RAP with incitement to riot charges that were then raised to the federal level. August 1967, he's one of the five people named in the famous COINTELPRO memo. The FBI circulate around that time. So the memo names Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael, Max Stanford, Elijah Muhammad, and H.R.A.P. Brown as the five people that they're kind of most concerned about, most wanting to target. As you know, as I'm sure your listeners know, COINTELPRO was about what they call neutralizing the Black Freedom Movement.
We should note that he's a tall man. I read that he's about 6 foot 5 inches tall, and we opened the show in the introduction with a quotation talking about his booming voice emboldening a generation of Black youth and frightening the white establishment. Why did the government target him, and was it related, in your opinion, to this incident? Or was it for his political power?
So time and time again, when you speak to people from that generation, they cite H.R.A.P. Brown as the person who kind of politicized them, inspired them to get involved in radical politics. And that was due to this capacity he had of communicating in a way that, anyone could understand. He was giving people an analysis of where the Black Freedom Movement needed to go at that time, putting it in an international context, making connections between the Black struggle here, the struggle against imperialism globally, the Puerto Rican struggle, the Palestinian struggle. He was talking about all these things. That is why he was targeted. I mean, that's what he had in common with those other people that I mentioned a moment ago in the COINTELPRO memo. Simply a matter of political repression. I think what's distinctive about his case is the way that for the next few years he's kind of in and out of courtrooms in about five different states. Charge after charge is being introduced to him, and all these charges collapse within a few years. But this is what people call lawfare. This is essentially bringing charges that it doesn't matter if they're valid, but it takes your it takes you up all your time and resources for the next few years, and it prevents you from doing the activism work that you would otherwise be doing.
Are you saying that he was charged while in prison? And how many years was he in prison for that first?
So what happens is he's charged in the summer of 1967 with the riot charge. Then he's added to that, and linked to that is another charge that's to do with carrying a gun while under indictment, but he wasn't aware of the indictment. So that charge piggybacks on the first charge, right? 5 years later, both of those charges are thrown out of court when they eventually come to trial. He spends a few months in prison in spring of 1968 while he's trying to get bail on the second of those charges, right? Basically, he's having to marshal huge amounts of resources for bail, for the legal costs. His energies are focused on addressing these cases. And one of the bail conditions is that he's not allowed to leave the Southern District of New York. So, you know, he, as the chair of SNCC, you know, his job is to travel around the country mobilizing and communicating with communities around the country, but he's effectively prevented from traveling at that time. Eventually, the trial for the riot charges is set to take place in Bel Air in Maryland in 1970. The days before the trial is going to start, a car bomb goes off that kills two of Rapp's closest comrades. The government says that they were carrying a bomb that they were going to plant at the courthouse. So it accidentally goes off before they plant it, but everyone in the movement is convinced that this is an assassination attempt on Rapp.
That's just like the Judy Barrett case in California.
Say, that's not a new tactic here,
right, by the
government.
It's kind of been forgotten about. I've done a Freedom of Information request to the FBI and got all their files on their investigation into it, and it's clear that their investigation is doesn't really have any legs and doesn't go anywhere, so they don't really know what happened. So after that, Rapp goes underground for about 18 months, right? Because he's in fear of his life. And by the way, that's the second of four assassination attempts in his life. He goes underground. The government doesn't know where he is for the next 18 months. He's spending quite a lot of time in New York City doing work underground. At this point, he's interested in the issue of drugs being introduced into black communities, often with a connection to the government, and he's aware of the collusion between the New York Police Department and the drug business in New York City, and he's concerned about the impact of that on the community. He's doing that work underground. He also travels to Tanzania, where there's a lot of other SNCC leaders have gathered. He spends some time there.
Arun, H. Rapp Brown then conversed to Islam, as did Muhammad Ali. A real affront to white sensibilities. And when did that occur? And then he became a leader in the mosque. Talk about that, please.
So soon after he arrives in Rikers Island prison in 1971, he meets with a group of black Muslims who are from an organization called the Darul Islam. And that's an organization that has kind of grown up in Brooklyn in the 1960s. It's different from the Nation of Islam. It's got its roots more in kind of the import of ideas from the Middle East rather than the Nation of Islam, which is something slightly different. So he converts to Islam, and he then spends the next 5 years in the New York prison system. When he leaves in 1976, he settles in Atlanta, Georgia. He travels to Saudi Arabia. Dick Gregory pays for his travel costs to do the Hajj. And he becomes a leader of the Muslim community that he establishes in Atlanta, Georgia, and builds up a community there. He runs a community grocery store. He becomes an imam. He clears the neighborhood of drugs. By the 90s, becomes one of the prominent leaders of Islam in the United States. He's important in the American Muslim response to the Bosnian genocide in the early 90s. He becomes one of the leaders of Islam in this country. And from the early 90s, he again is subject to intense targeting and surveillance by the FBI.
Let's fast forward here. He's once again in prison. He's been in prison for many, many years. Why is it that he's once again in prison?
So from the early 90s, especially after the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, the Muslim community in the United States is targeted quite intensely by the FBI for surveillance, and he's seen as someone who is especially important. So he's now being framed under that label of kind of Islamic extremism by the FBI. They're sending in informants into his congregation. There's an attempt in 1995 to trump up murder charges on him that collapsed pretty quickly. In 2000, there's a shootout in the neighborhood where his mosque is based. One police officer is killed, another is survives, and this surviving officer testifies that it was Jamil al-Amin, as is known by this time, who was the perpetrator. So he goes to trial in 2002, not a good time for a Muslim leader to go on trial. It's pretty soon after 9/11, and he's charged with the murder of the police officer. The case has a number of major flaws in it, one of which is someone else has confessed to the murder. So we have an affidavit from someone else who's actually confessed to doing this. We have, you know, identification evidence that's incredibly weak. The officer's describing someone completely different from the way that Jamil al-Amin actually looks. I mean, we can go into the detail of the case more if you want, but the gun that is the main thing that you know is kind of weighty evidence against him, apparently. There's an officer in Alabama where the gun is found who says in his statement that it looks like it's been planted, right? But nevertheless, he's convicted. He then is in the Georgia state prison system from that period on to about 2004.
I understand he did a lot of time in solitary confinement while incarcerated.
Yeah, so what happens? Well, here's what happens. So in the Georgia state prison system, word spreads pretty quickly that this guy who's you know got a certain history is in the system, and Muslim prisoners in particular start to say that we want him to be our leader, our representative in the prison system. That generates a lot of anxiety from the authorities, particularly in this kind of you know period soon after 9/11. So the FBI do an analysis and they say, you know, he's a radicalizing influence amongst Muslim prisoners in the Georgia state prison system, and that becomes the pretext for him to be transferred out of the Georgia state prison system into federal custody. And he spends the next 10 years in ADX Florence, Colorado, which is, you know, the supermax prison where al-Qaeda accused prisoners are held deep underground in solitary confinement. You don't see daylight. You don't have any human contact or barely any human contact. And you have very little communication. And so he's held there for 10 years.
This is an important point to repeat. You're saying that he was transferred by the authorities from state jurisdiction to federal jurisdiction based on his association, the climate of 9/11, but the crime wasn't a federal crime.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's not been convicted of any federal crime at this point. So, and you know, it's worth also adding that, you know, the kind of medical evidence in relation to solitary confinement of the kind that happens at ADX Florence says, you know, after about 3 months, this is mental torture, right? And it's considered a serious human rights violation. We're talking about 10 years. You know, I've spoken to him on the phone occasionally, and you know, I correspond with him by post. His mental composure is completely intact after 10 years of that, and so there's something quite incredible about his kind of ability to survive that experience and his resilience. You know, so after 10 years he's transferred to other federal prisons, right? And right now he's in Tucson, Arizona, in the federal prison there, in the general population.
We're speaking with Professor Arun Khanani, who is writing a biography of al-Amin, who people may remember as H. Rapp Brown. He's one of the great leaders of the black freedom struggle since the 60s. He's been in prison now for, 17 years. And another person has confessed to the murder that he was falsely convicted of. When did you become interested in this case, Arun?
So I've been writing about civil rights issues around the war on terror within the United States and within the UK, where I'm from, for quite a while. In my last book, I looked at an incident that took place in 2009 when someone called Imam Luqman Abdullah was killed by the FBI in Detroit in a raid after an investigation they'd been running on him that was, again, trumped up charges. They'd infiltrated his congregation, accused him of being an al-Qaeda sympathizer, but there was nothing there. He was killed. He was targeted because he was a follower of Jamil al-Amin, H. Rapp Brown, and that was the kind of reason why he became interesting to the FBI. So that was what started my interest in Jamil al-Amin. I started looking at his story a little more, and of course, once you begin to look, you see that his story is a it connects a lot of different things that you know that we should be interested in. It connects the history of the Black Freedom Movement to Islamic movements that we've seen more recently. It connects the kind of COINTELPRO history of what the FBI was doing then to what the FBI has been doing under the War on Terror. It enables you to sort of see a lot of historical connections that would otherwise be harder to track.
And of course, the time that he was in the Supermax, in solitary, the public hears nothing about him because it's meant to cut off your communication with the outside world. Listeners may not know that his case is back in court. Can you explain briefly about that?
Well, so he's had an ongoing attempt. You know, obviously he's trying to challenge the conviction. He's been through the various levels of the court system. That's ongoing. Alongside that, he's also isolated. I want to do an in-person interview with him in Tucson, in the prison there in Tucson, Arizona. Other journalists and academics also want to do that. We've all been told, as journalists and academics, that we can't meet with him. So there's effectively a kind of unofficial gag order on him communicating with journalists and academics. So one of the things that I'm working on is trying to do a legal challenge to say that that's a violation of my First Amendment rights as a journalist and as a writer.
Because it's not applied evenly with every prisoner in that facility.
Turn on the television any day of the week and see, you know, television interviews with people who've been convicted of terrible crimes, right? There's not any general ban on communicating with federal prisoners who've done or accused of done awful things. But this is about stopping him communicating because he's been seen since the summer of 1967, someone who the government doesn't want to be able to speak, to be able to communicate with people in the broader society.
Does he have a support committee?
There is an organization called the Imam Jamil Action Network, or IJAN, and you can find them online. You can find them on Facebook, IJAN. So there's that. That's the main organization that's working around his case. That's the first point of call. You could also read the journalism of someone who's been covering the case very, very well, called Obaid Siddiqui. So his first name is Obaid, and then Siddiqui, Siddiqui.
Yes, we began our intro with a quote from one of his great articles.
So yeah, so Google his work on Jamil Al-Amin.
So you said he's appealing.
So right now in May he appealed in the federal court in Atlanta. That appeal was rejected. So now the legal team is considering next steps and possible petitions to the Supreme Court and things like that.
Is there anything that listeners can do to help in his effort? Writing letters?
So the best thing here is to look at the IJAN website. There's also his son has a very useful resource online called whathappenedtorap.org, I believe. The two is a digit, not the word. And that has a lot of resources on the case and on how you can support the case. You certainly can write letters to him in prison. That's not blocked, although sometimes they take months to reach him.
And they're read by the officials.
They will certainly most likely be read by.
How do we get his address?
It's on either of those websites that I've just given you, IJAN.
IJAN?
Yep, IJAN or whathappenedtorap.org. There's also a petition that people can sign that is calling for the Federal Bureau of Prisons to reverse its decision not to allow journalists and academics to be able to interview him in person, and that's. The website for that is kundnai.org/JAMILALAMIN. So in other words, mysurname.org/JamilAlamin.
And we'll put a link on our website in case listeners weren't able to get
sensible.
That all down.
Yeah.
Arun, we just have a few minutes remaining, but you've been working on his biography. Do you have a publisher yet?
I'm kind of holding back from getting a publisher right now until I'm a bit clearer on what the book looks like. Because if we're successful in this legal challenge, then the book looks very different. Because then, you know, the idea would be for me to spend 3 days in a federal prison with him, you know, getting his account. And essentially, that book then is very much centered on that interview with him. If we don't get that, then it's about the interviews I've done with all his associates and the archive research I've done. It will change what publisher is ideal.
You know, this is a real horror story of a secret police operation against a black leader who advocated no crimes whatsoever. He was just silenced. Can you give us in a nutshell what the MO of the FBI, which I would define as the American Secret Police Force, what was their MO against him? And are they using that now?
So back then, you know, we can actually get inside the heads of what they were doing back then to a large degree, because a lot of the FBI surveillance records and a lot of the correspondence between Hoover and Johnson is now available for us to look at. I mean, there's memos going from Hoover at the FBI to the White House through 67, 68, almost every day, with an analysis of what H.Rap Brown is up to that day. That's the extent of the tracking of him. And there's an FBI agent based in the Atlanta field office at the time whose full-time job is writing these, you know, huge analyses of who H.Rap Brown is from their point of view. And he does this every few months with updated material, and all that's available because it ends up in the Kerner Commission into the that Johnson set up into the riots, and then that's in the Lyndon Baines Johnson Library in Austin, Texas, so you can look at it. And then we get, you know, his legal team in the 70s did freedom of information requests after we became aware of COINTELPRO and got a load of material, and his wife, Karima Alamine, has done... She's a lawyer. She's done work as well, getting freedom of information material from the 90s. So we have there's obviously a lot more. We think there's probably something like 100,000 pages of surveillance from the FBI. He might be the most surveilled person in the history of the FBI because he surveilled, you know, he's top of the list in the kind of late 60s, early 70s when they're going after the black movement. But then he's also, a key figure in the kind of 90s and post 9/11 period when they're going after Islamic extremism. So that whole, you know, that all adds up to possibly the most surveilled person in that history. Possibly, certainly, I would say of the kind of political people they've surveilled, it looks like he's probably one of the most surveilled. So, you know, what were they looking for? What they think was the problem? Back in the late 60s, their whole way of framing this question is in terms of communism. Actually, right, weirdly, they actually, when you read this stuff, they have no idea who Rapp really is, right? But what they think he might be is a communist, and that's what they're looking for, right? And so they understand that he's you know, an influential and powerful figure, able to communicate with, you know, as the Panthers would have put it, the guys on the corner, right? And that's his power, right? But their concern is that power going to be used to mobilize on behalf of communism or socialism, right? That's how they frame it. And they believe that they found that. Hoover thinks he's you know, along with the other leaders that they're looking at, that they're essentially introducing communism into the black community, and that's what they're about, which is obviously a very strange interpretation of what they're doing. In the period in the 90s, it's framed through the question of Islam, right? What you have in both the communist, when it's a communist question and the Islam question, it's as much about the international dimensions, right? Rapp is the first person in this period, you know, in a leadership position in the Black Freedom Movement to talk about the connections between the Black struggle and the Palestinian struggle. Like, he's doing that in 1967, right? Kind of fall 1967. He's making the connections between the black struggle, the Puerto Rican struggle, massive influence on the formation of the Young Lords in the US. He's making connections to movements in Mexico. He's a key figure in thinking about what is going to happen in the Mexico Olympics in 1968 that ends up with the Black Power Salute. But he's organizing around that from a year before, building connections with movements in Mexico around the Olympics. He's got connections with movements in the Caribbean, in Southern Africa. You know, that sense of internationalism, I think, must have been terrifying to the FBI at that time, right? When he goes underground for 18 months in 1970, 1971, he's on the CIA's radar, right? The CIA are tracking him. We have some of that material, right? So, you know, they're looking for him everywhere. They're putting memos out to all the field offices around the world, so, you know, with his photo saying, you know, can you find this guy? Memos start coming back from field offices around the world. Yeah, we found him, and he's in Hong Kong. Someone else thinks, yeah, we found him, he's in Algeria. No one knows where he is. They don't know, right? But, you know, to them, I guess every black American looks the same, right? And so they're kind of thinking they've seen him. But, you know, he's able to evade detection throughout that whole period. A lot of the time he's simply hanging out in East Harlem. But what's terrifying to them is that he can make those, you know, he can see this bigger picture of how the black freedom struggle fits into broader international struggles to create a different world. And that's the same with Islam in the 90s. Essentially, it's Islam is seen as a vehicle that connects him to the Palestinian struggle again, to struggles in the Middle East, in the broader world that have an Islamic framing.
Arun, before we let you go, how old is he now and how is his health?
He had a bit of a health scare a few years ago, and that's the basis on which we were able to campaign for him to be removed from ADX Florence, Colorado, and transferred to the general population. He's okay now. He's doing pretty well. Apparently, he even occasionally plays basketball in Tucson, Arizona. He is 76 years old. He was 76 in October.
You know, when you were talking about their campaign of surveillance against him, it reminded me of the work that Michael Ratner and I did. We finally produced a book called How and Why the CIA Assassinated Che Guevara. They did the same thing to Che Guevara for the same reasons.
Absolutely. There is a list of people who've been assassinated, you know, in this period in the late 60s, Fred Hampton, et cetera, et cetera. There is a list of people who've been, you know, who've been imprisoned and have never, and, you know, from the early 1970s and still remain incarcerated. There is people who've abandoned the movement and sold out and turned to various kinds of right wing politics or advanced their careers. In a way, you know, there's something quite unique about Jamil Al-Amin, right? That he was able to actually build some kind of project in Atlanta. After he came out in 1976 until 2000, when he's incarcerated again, where he kind of created something, you know. And I think many of the other examples of similar figures to him didn't get the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, he reminds me of the great work that Mumia Abu-Jamal was doing before they managed to send him away.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very interesting time, this period in the early 70s, when some of the optimism of the late 60s in the movement has evaporated, right? It seems like this is a moment of defeat. It's in that context that a lot of people convert to Islam, and Jamil Al-Amin is one of them. Islam seems to offer an alternative way of thinking about what this movement might be about, right? That's why it becomes quite a phenomenon at the time of conversion. It's interesting how that plays out later.
Arun, we are anxiously awaiting your book. I know it's probably going to be a while, but we look forward to having you back on, and we look forward to having our listeners learn more and help advocate on behalf of Jamil Al-Amin. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.